everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have been teasing this for a while, and I have, that I have a wonderful guest for us today. And his name is William Wellman Jr., and he is a son of Wild Bill Wellman, and who is an amazing director who directed so many films. You guys probably don't even know he was the one who directed them, and they are incredible. So, and William Bill Jr. wrote a wonderful book on him. The book is called Wild Bill Wellman, Hollywood Rebel, and what a great book, Bill. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Grace. I appreciate that. That book was, it only took me 9 years to write that book, but it took me 25 years to do the documentary I did on my
Really? Father. The documentary was amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's you know, it's won awards all over the world.
No, it's great.
And I went through so much to get that done. You know, I felt back in the, my father's last released film was 1958. And so that was like the second year that I was working in the industry as an actor. And I felt pretty soon, now I was a working actor and I was working at all the studios. And I had Junior after my name, but I could see that the new people who were taking over Hollywood and the studios, they didn't know who my father was, and his work was being forgotten. And it really bothered me, and I couldn't understand it. So I decided, well, I'm going to do something about it. So parallel with my own career, I was shining a light on my father's career of over 80 films that he directed.
Some masterpieces, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, his films received 32 Academy Award nominations and 7 Oscars.
Amazing. 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 And his life is like incredible. It's just not just like you said that
which
your
one he had 5 of them, you know.
His life. We didn't get to the wives yet. His life. He lived 100
lives.
Well, you
know, I think for a long time my father would marry anyone who would date him twice.
I think so. It was so funny because when I'm reading it, and again, he never contacted his mother or father until after he was married. Even with Dottie.
Once he married my mother, she straightened him out. He used to tell people, "I'm housebroken now." And they had a wonderful marriage, 42 years for the rest of his life. And he really was happy. He really found the woman that he wanted. But he was too wild and crazy before.
I agree. And he was never around.
He couldn't settle down.
No, he couldn't. And he just found his perfect partner. And their story, which we'll get to later, because I really love that too, that part of his life, not just his films, but I loved his personal life and his family life that was so important to him as well. But the book pretty much starts out, your dad was, this was World War One. He wanted to be a pilot, and he joined the French Foreign Legion, correct, to become...
Well, actually, he started the... He had to get over to France somehow, because America was neutral. We were not in the war.
Right.
So what he did is he joined the ambulance corps... Mm-hmm. The Norton Hargis Ambulance Corps, and that got him to France. Then, in order to get into French service, he had to join or transfer into the French Foreign Legion. That got him into French service. And then from there, he could get into pilot training and become a member of the French Flying Corps, which was called the Lafayette Flying Corps. It's a little tricky here because a lot of people say he was in the Lafayette Escadrille.
Yes, I read that.
But that's not exactly true. The Escadrille was formed. The French formed the Escadrille as a way to allow Americans to come into the war. So it was all Americans that were in the Escadrille. But my father came in later, and there was no room in the Escadrille. So that's how he got into the French, the Lafayette Flying Corps, and was able to keep his citizenship and be an American and all that, and fly for France.
And so, with the one he did join, that wasn't just American flyers, right?
No, no. He was now, he actually joined a group of all Frenchmen. Hmm. He was the only American, and in that particular escadrille, which is escadrille is what we would say is corps, you know, mm-hmm. the escadrille. And he was the only American there in the beginning.
I got to ask you this. How old was your dad when he joined?
Well, he was, let's see, he was born in 1896. So he was four, he was 17, he was 19. I think he was 21. Let's see. Let's go from 19. He went into service in 1917. So that would be 17, 18, 19, 20. He'd be 21
and
when he went into combat.
He really wanted to fight that war, and he wanted to fly. And boy, did he do it. He did.
Well, you know, that's sort of the outstanding way to say it. But actually, he just wanted to get the hell out of Boston because he was a juvenile delinquent.
And your mother was a parole or something, right? Wasn't she?
His mother was the parole officer.
Oh, your grandma.
He was assigned to her.
That's a riot.
So, I mean, he was in so much trouble that he just wanted to get away. And the idea of flying, which he had he used to travel up to northern part of Massachusetts, where there was a flying field up there, and he got to know pilots and all of that, and mm-hmm. got excited about flying. So the idea of getting away, getting out of town, and flying sent him to France. That's how it happened.
So it wasn't really like gung-ho, I want to mow these people down.
No.
I want to
no.
get away, and I want to fly.
Yeah. He said it's either war or jail.
Oh,
that's
boy.
That's what he said.
Wow. And so prior to that, he was also a hockey player, right?
Yeah, well, he got kicked out of high school. He got kicked out of high school for dropping a stink bomb on the bald head of the principal.
Oh, my.
Because the principal had taken away his privileges because he had gotten in trouble and he wasn't doing his studies. And so that's how my father got his retribution. But then he got kicked out of high school.
I bet he didn't mind.
He was a superior hockey player in high school. Mm-hmm. And he went with a semi-pro team in Boston and played in Boston as a professional ice hockey player. So that's how he got into hockey.
And he could also, were they slugging it out then too, hockey players?
Oh yeah. You know, people ask me because a lot of people know about fights that he had when he was in Hollywood mm-hmm. and, you know, it was just mostly he fought for his films. He didn't want any interference on his films. And when the executives at whatever studio he was at would come down to the set and want to make directorial decisions, you know, he knocked a lot of them on their rear ends. He would fight. So,
literally.
In a way. Yeah, literally. So he's fighting for his film.
Right.
And he would also fight for his troupe, his actors and his the crew. But to be honest, he really liked to fight. He did like to fight.
That's something. So, yeah, and he did it a lot. That's for sure.
Yeah, he did.
And he did not like authority.
No. He did not like authority, that's for sure.
Yeah, so we went to France, and I don't want to talk about the first one yet. I want to do where you walked with your dad and how you found out. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, we knew he had four marriages.
Right.
But those are the only ones that anybody had chronicled. And we had a trip. He was invited to London for a retrospective of his work. Mm-hmm. And he had never had a retrospective of his work in the United States until I produced one. And he had one here. And he had one in London. And on the way over, he said, I want to go back to Paris. I want to go back to France. So this is my mother, my wife, and I, four of us. Mm-hmm. So after the retrospective in London was completed, we flew to Paris. And he was, you know, once we got there, he was grousing the whole time about how it had changed. And I said, well, Dad, you haven't been here since 1918. We're now talking 1973.
Wow.
Of course, it's changed. So one day, we were there for several days. One day, he said, in the morning at breakfast, he said to my mother, he said, look, you and Flossie, Flossie's my wife, mm-hmm. you guys go shopping because Bill and I are going somewhere. So we got in a cab and we went outside of Paris to the memorial to the Americans who fought for France during the war. And it was an amazing place. And he told me about, you know, the men that were his friends and all of that. And on the way back, he said, I want to stop somewhere. So he told the cab driver, just drive slowly. And he started giving him instructions like, go down here, turn right at this street. And then he'd say, no, that's not it. Go left here. And I said, Dad, what do you, you know, what are you looking at? Tell me, maybe I can help you with the directions. He said, no, goddammit, I'll find it. And finally, we're driving up this one street, and he says to the cab driver, stop the car. So he stopped the car. My father gets out, and he's just standing, looking across the street. So I get out, and I come around. I'm standing next to him, and I'm looking at him, and he's like in another world. You know, he's just thinking.
He's lost in his own thoughts.
Yeah, and I said, Dad, what do you see? What are you thinking? He says, well, do you see that building across the street? And there was kind of a crumbled building. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, yeah. He says, that's the church that I got married in. And I said, to who? I mean, nobody knew about this. And he said, that was my first wife. And he told me about her. She was a French gal that he met during his training to be a pilot in France. And she followed him. And he was down when he was when he joined the escadrille. He was in Lunéville, in the southeastern part of France. Mm-hmm. And she came down there and worked in the bakery in the town. And after, oh, I don't know, I forget now exactly how much time, then they got married. They went to Paris and they got married, and they were married for 2 months. Now, she had a sister who was pregnant living in Paris, and so Renee was my dad's wife's name. Mm-hmm. She said, I have to go to Paris to help my sister. She's going to give birth. So she left. So after a while, my father decided to go and find her. And he found the maternity hospital, a small maternity hospital that the sister had been taken to. And it had been completely obliterated. At this time during the war, the Germans had perfected a long-distance cannon. And they used to fire shells into Paris. Now, they couldn't really hit exactly what they wanted, but they just wanted to cause, you know,
mayhem
death. And so, yeah. Believe it or not, I mean, this is just so horrible. My father ends up finding this maternity hospital, and the gendarmes had arrived there ahead of time, and they were going through and finding bits and pieces of babies and mothers, and oh my God, it must have been. And my father found Renee. Excuse me, but it gets me every time I talk about this.
Well, I cried when I read that.
He found her, and he could tell by the ring that he had given her on her finger. And, of course, she was dead.
And isn't that, pretty much the only thing he found of her was just her arm?
Not much, yeah, an arm and the hand, and, you know, it was just awful. And so no one knew this except his best friend, Tommy Hitchcock, who had joined him in the escadrille at Lunéville. And Hitchcock never told anybody. And my father never told anybody. And many years later, when he started to write his memoirs, and he wrote two books, one was published, and he wrote about her, just a couple of pages in the book about her. And that's really, so he really just kind of put it on the back burner of his life and told anybody. And then he finally, you know, I found out about it the time that he wrote a little about it.
Did your mom know?
No, she didn't know either. She found out when I found out. So it was pretty amazing.
It's so sad, you know.
And it was so, you know, it was, my father is, you have to understand, my father is the kind of a person that would talk about anything. You know, mm-hmm. there was nothing was taboo with him. He'd talk about anything. If you asked him, if you interviewed him, he would tell you whatever you asked right there, he would come right out with it. And a lot of times he would say things that I thought he was embarrassing the people he was talking about, that he shouldn't be saying that. But that's just the way he was. And yet he never talked about this, his first wife, until many years later. And he didn't talk about her much then. It was still painful to him.
I can't even imagine. And in the documentary and in the book, it's so true. When you see these films directed by men who had actually been in the war, or acted by people who have been in the war, it is so different than people who have not, because they kind of make it more, not quite as heavy, more frothy, more whatever, because they haven't been there. They've never seen
the horror. Yeah, well, it's more real. They can make it more realistic.
Right. So how did your dad get to Hollywood? Let's get him into Hollywood.
Well, after the war, he had six major air crashes during the war, and the last one sent him home. He was shot down by anti-aircraft. He always joked about that. He said, they couldn't hit anything, but they hit me. So he was pretty busted up, and he was sent home, and he rehabbed at home, but he wanted to get back into action. But nobody would take him after his injuries. So what he did is he got a job as a trainer, a flying instructor at Rockwell Field in San Diego, and he spent the end of the war as a flight instructor. He had met a movie star, Helene Chadwick. She was a rising star at the Goldwyn Studios, and he met her, and they got married, and that got him to Hollywood. Now he was in Hollywood, and he reunited with Douglas Fairbanks. Douglas Fairbanks had met my father when my father was playing ice hockey in Boston. Fairbanks liked hockey, and he would come to the hockey matches, and he took a liking to my father, probably because he was spending so much time in the penalty box for fighting.
And he still have his real teeth?
Yeah, they actually had a friendship, and Fairbanks invited my father backstage of the play he was doing in Boston, which was called Hawthorne of the USA. And at this time, Fairbanks was not a movie star. He was a star of stage.
But was he with Mary Pickford at that time, or no?
No, not yet, no. Not yet. And what he told my father was, if you ever need a job, come out to Hollywood, because I'm going to go out and get in the movies. Come out to Hollywood, and I'll get you a job. So after the war was over, my father actually flew up from Rockwell Field in his bad aircraft and landed on the polo field where Douglas Fairbanks, and now he's with Mary Pickford, but they're not married, they were having a party. Because in those days, in the late 1920 21 like that. Beverly Hills and the surrounding area was full of polo fields. There were a lot of them. Polo was a very, you know, something that everyone was involved with. And my father found out that Fairbanks was having this big polo party, and he flew and landed on the polo field. Can you imagine the polo horse, the polo pony skittering around as this Spad aircraft comes flying in?
And he's got some chutzpah there. We've got to give that to your father.
And he,
grand entrance.
He knew Fairbanks was going to be there, and he had his best uniform with all his medals and everything. And
he was duded
marched up. Yeah, he marched up to Fairbanks and reintroduced himself, and he said, "Do you remember me, Mr. Fairbanks?" And Fairbanks, "Yes, I remember you. You're Wild Bill. And can you ride a horse?" And my father said, "No, but I've ridden everything else." And Fairbanks actually got him the second lead, the young lead, in his next picture, which was a Western called the Knickerbocker Buckaroo in 1919. And now my father was in Hollywood.
And he made his acting debut. Was he married to that actress still at that time?
He was married to her. And actually, they had, let's see, they had just divorced. I'm forgetting my timeline here. But I think they had divorced at this time. She was doing a film in Catalina, of all places, and he went over to surprise her and caught her in bed with the leading man. And that, you know, that was the end of that marriage.
Surprise, and, yeah.
Now he was single again and working as an actor in the Douglas Fairbanks picture, and then he did one other film that was directed by Raoul Walsh called Evangeline. And he didn't like being an actor. You know, he didn't like it. He didn't like when he saw himself on the screen. And he went to Fairbanks and he said, "I appreciate you getting me this job and everything. But, you know, I just don't want to be an actor."
It's hard to watch yourself on screen. Didn't he, after he saw himself the first time at a movie theater, he went into the bathroom and threw up?
Yeah, he left the theater and went to the bathroom and threw up and didn't want to be an actor. And Fairbanks said, "Well, you know, I understand, but what do you want to do?" And my father said, "Well, how much do you pay your director?" And Fairbanks told him. My father says, "I want to be a director." Fairbanks said, "Well, I can't make you a director, but I'll get you started." But what he got him was as a messenger boy at the Goldwyn Studios, which is the bottom rung. There's nothing lower than the messenger boy. And my father worked his way up. You know, he worked in the editing room. He became an assistant director. He worked his way up to becoming a director.
And he did his first... Wings was not his first movie he directed, was it?
Oh, no. No. He did seven silent westerns and three non-westerns before he did Wings. So he did 10 pictures before Wings.
And what, you know what? I've never seen it, and it's on my, I have to watch that.
Oh, you, Grace, you have to see it. It's, even today, now I've got it written down here because I, you know, I've been on speaking tour since 2015. I've done 28 events, Wings events, in five countries.
How cool.
It still holds up. People are amazed today when they see it. It's so amazing.
I saw clips of it, and I, you know, he demanded the realism. He, was it? Richard Arlen, Buddy Rogers, and the It Girl, Clara Bow. They wanted her in for market value. But didn't he make them learn to fly?
Well, you know, that's one of the wonderful stories, and there's so many stories of Wings. But that one, nobody had ever made a full feature about aviation. There had been little bits of aviation, usually stunts, in pictures, and there had been some government films, but nobody had ever done this. So the idea of all of a sudden going up and photographing dogfights and the pilots themselves in the aircraft had not been done before, and my father and his crew had to invent the aerial aerial warfare for the movies.
Yeah, because they used to say that the planes never got off the ground when they
when they you know, a stunt, you know, would be photographed from a distance. But what they had to do was to get up and get close to the plane and get cameras onto the planes. So this took a lot of work to figure out how to do it. And getting back to your question, one of the problems was in order to, when they finally decided to put cameras on the planes, bolt them to the fuselage of the planes and have the camera, you know, facing the pilot, now, you know, the pilot actually, you know, the man who was the actor had to be the pilot. So he had to know how to fly the plane for at least a period of time. So he had Buddy Rogers and Richard Arlen take flying lessons while on the location. I mean, can you imagine, I often thought to myself, can you imagine saying to, let's say, Brad Pitt, oh, by the way, Brad, you're going to have to take some flying lessons because you're going to fly the plane while you're being photographed. I mean, can you imagine doing this? But that's what my father did.
And that's so, at the time, so unheard of. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It had not been done before.
Never.
And now, fortunately, Richard Arlen had some flying experience, not much, but Buddy Rogers, nothing, zero. So he took his flying lessons, and when they photographed him in the air, they would he would go up in a two-cockpit plane, and the pilot, a real pilot, would be in the second seat and duck down so that you couldn't see him, and then the camera, Buddy Rogers, would turn on the camera and become, so he's the cameraman, he would become the director, the actor, and the pilot for 400 feet, because there were 400-foot rolls in a camera. So that's what they did.
And that's called acting. And also, you know, really, I mean.
Well, my father said that Buddy Rogers, every time that he came back down and landed, he would get out of the airplane and throw up. But he would be ready to go back up.
Wow, that's
a
trooper.
But
yeah. I have to tell you, Bill, as I was watching the documentary, I'm watching and seeing wings and going up in the clouds and seeing these planes fly. And I got chills. And I said, why in the world have I never seen this film? And I can't wait to see it. And I will. And I just, it was amazing. And also, he discovered someone in that film, that hunky Gary Cooper, who only had one line. And it was a doozy because he got...
Yeah, well, he had actually cast Gary Cooper, you know, at the studio. And he had looked at, I think there was some number like 30-odd actors before he chose him. And I think he chose him because he was very much like a friend of my father's, one of his flying buddies during the war. And because he was tall and thin and just like Gary Cooper. So he picked Gary Cooper, and it made Gary Cooper a star. And it's amazing to see the scene with Gary Cooper, which the scene was written by my father, I know. Now, nobody has an original script of Wings. Nobody has it. There isn't. Wherever there is one, I don't know. I've never heard of it. No one's ever come forth with one. But what we do know is when my father came on the picture, he worked with the writer, John Monk Saunders, for, you know, weeks. And so we don't know exactly what my father added to it. But knowing as much as I know about his actual experience as a pilot during the war, I can pick out things that were the same, that were exactly the same. And the Gary Cooper scene, Gary Cooper gets killed in the film. And this happened to a friend of my father's during training, killed exactly the same way during a training exercise. So I feel like my father put that in. And other things, too, because there are a number of episodes in Wings that were exactly like my father's during the war.
And as a tribute to his friends, I'm sure, and the men that lost their lives.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Your dad broke his back, and what? He had to have a silver plate in his head?
Yeah, he had to put the French doctors put a silver plate in his head. This was all from when he got shot down by anti-aircraft fire and crashed, and his back was broken in two places, and he had the control stick had gone through the roof of his mouth.
Ugh.
And he had a silver plate put in his head, and it's kind of funny because many years later, he used to have headaches all the time. Mm-hmm. And at one point, the modern doctors did some X-rays and all, and the plate had dissolved. So, anyway.
That doesn't usually happen, right?
No. But, you know, my father was busted up pretty good, but he, you know, he was strong, and he was, he didn't let it stop him. But eventually, one of the reasons he stopped working was because he developed really bad arthritis, and he'd just been, too many problems, physical problems.
Yes.
That stopped him.
But his Wings.
Plus, go on. His last released movie was called The Lafayette Escadrille. Now, that wasn't my father's title. My father's title was C'est la vie. C'est la guerre, mm-hmm. which means, it's the war. And my father wrote this, and the leading lady is Renee, his first wife, based on his first wife.
Yes.
French wife. And all of his buddies are in that picture, they're characters.
And you, didn't you play him?
Yeah, and that's a weird thing that happened. That happened. The studio did that because when they were casting the movie, my father wanted James Dean. Mm-hmm. My father made the movie at Warner's, and James Dean was under contract to Warner's, and my father wanted James Dean to play him. I mean, to play the lead guy.
Right.
Which was not really my father, but it kind of was my father, based on my father, let's say. And James Dean was killed in an automobile accident. So then my father wanted Paul Newman, who was a new contract actor at the studio, and actually met him. And they didn't really get along that well at the meeting, but my father said, well, he's a kind of a rebel, and that's what I want. And Jack Warner said, well, you can't use him because he's giving us a lot of trouble. He doesn't like the projects we're giving him. So we're going to put him on suspension. So then Jack Warner talked my father into using Tab Hunter, who was a star at the studio and actually a major star at the time. And my father liked Tab Hunter. He used him in a picture called Track of the Cap with Robert Mitchum.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't really against it, but it wasn't really what my father wanted. And the problem was, now, with Tab Hunter in the lead, the studio looked at it as a Tab Hunter film. And Tab Hunter films were all kinds of things. They were Westerns, and they were all sorts of films. But because Tab Hunter was such a major star with the teenagers...
He also sang.
They couldn't... The character in my father's story was killed at the end. Well, they shot it that way, but... The studio would not accept Tab Hunter being killed. And they changed the movie. They re-edited the movie to focus on the love story and not focus on the pilots. So it became something that was not what my father had wanted. And he, at that point, he was having a lot of physical problems. And he just said, I don't want this anymore. And he quit the business.
And that's something. He didn't get canned. Contract players in the studios, those days were gone. They were over.
Yeah, but the studios, like Warner Brothers, they still had contract players, but they were a different kind of play. Warner Brothers, they were still looking for matinee idols, mm-hmm. and they were hiring people. They had people like Troy Donahue under contract, and they, you know, I don't mean to be too negative about Tab Hunter. You have to understand that he was a star mm-hmm. at the time. He was really, in my mind, the Tom Cruise of the 50s.
Yes.
Because when in Tom Cruise's early career, he locked up all the teenagers. They loved him. And that's the same thing with Tab Hunter. But before the movie that became known as the Lafayette Escadrille was released, the word came out in Confidential and magazines that Tab Hunter was gay. Well, in those days, nobody was gay.
Right.
As far as what the public thought, everyone was in the closet. So the fact that that came out and that kind of ruined Tab Hunter's career certainly hurt it. And it hurt the picture, and they held the picture out of release for quite a long time. And this is for another reason. Tab Hunter had become a singing star. He had the number one song in the country.
What was it called? And The Twist?
It was called
Young
Love.
I know it wasn't The Twist. What was it?
It was called Young Love. And Jack Warner didn't like the fact that Tab Hunter's singing career was so successful, and he wasn't getting any of the money from it because he had Tab Hunter under contract
right.
as an actor, not as a singer. So what he did was, Tab Hunter was what his he was being his record company was also partly owned by Paramount Studios. So legally, Jack Warner could get a stop on that because that entered into kind of into the movie end of the business because he was Warner Brothers and the record company was partly Paramount, and Tab Hunter was supposed to be only under contract to Warner Brothers for movies. So somehow he got that worked out. So he decided, Jack Warner decided, to start Warner Brothers Records. And it took him 6 or 8 months to get that up and going. And now he could have Tab Hunter as a singer as well as an actor.
And get the profits as well.
Yeah, and but this whole business about Tab Hunter being gay and everything came out, and that really, and the movie just, it really killed the movie.
The club with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is me. Entertainment, the life.